From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Sweet tea is a staple of the Southern table.
One of the members of the House of Representatives, as a joke, created a bill that said if you're a restaurant serving unsweet tea, you must serve sweet tea.
We'll learn more about the history of sweet tea and also delve into the politics of barbecue this hour. We'll also get a couple more tracks added to the Essential Georgia playlist. But first, please take just a couple minutes to support this show. We're on day two of our fall fund drive, so go to gpb.org, click donate, or call 800-222-4788. Either way, it's only going to take you a couple of minutes, and thank you. Barbecue is truly Southern food, and it's serious business. Almost everyone has an opinion on the best way to cook, flavor, and serve barbecue. But it's controversial for another reason. Barbecue has its roots in slavery, and some popular restaurants have decidedly racist pasts. We talked about the political side to barbecue a few months ago with Kathleen Purvis, food writer with the Charlotte Observer, also Chuck Reese, editor for the Bitter Southerner, and Michael Twitty, a food writer and historian. Okay, so Michael, can we first address this idea that barbecue is the most political food in the country? Can we sort of at this point leave racism out of it and just ask whether it's political or not?
It's political by the very fact of the nature. It was the food that fueled political gatherings. I mean, that's the probably the biggest thing about it, is that this was a food tradition that was used to manipulate and lubricate, the course of American democracy, and the fact that for so long, and even to this day, the power source of that democracy was among, you know, the Southern elite, and that's undeniable. I mean, from Washington to Jackson to post-Civil War to even today, that barbecue is a major way to manipulate and sway the course of who votes what.
Kathleen, why is that? Why did barbecue become the type of food that is so often associated with political gatherings and rallies?
Well, I think there are two reasons for that. One of them is that it's something everyone enjoys. The other reason is because when we're in the campaign season is typically when hogs were slaughtered, and it was the time of year to do large barbecues. It was after the harvest was when people were considering who was going to be on the stump. And you want to get a whole bunch of people together and put them in a really, really good mood. You put a pig in a hole in the ground and cook it and then give it away.
And Chuck, do you think it's fair to say that barbecue is just a truly, regardless of its roots in Africa and in the Caribbean, but at this point, is barbecue an American food?
Well, yeah, I guess it is. But, you know, the thing about all Southern food is that it has elements of African and Caribbean cuisine in it. You know, the easiest thing to look at is a pot of okra to figure that out.
Okay, people might be upset by what you just said. They might not want, for food is very personal to people, and some people want to think that that's part of an American tradition, that it doesn't come from Africa.
Well, I'm sorry if it would upset people, but, it really is the case. You know, if you look at, almost every Southern cuisine has the influences of people who were brought here against their will originally. But there are things, you know, there's also a little joy in that when the things do come together to make a great dish. You know, food brings us together to talk about the things that are difficult to talk about. Honestly, it's really, usually when I'm talking to Kathleen and Michael, we're talking about this kind of stuff, but there's whiskey involved.
This is public radio. There's no whiskey here. I just want to make that perfectly clear.
That's y'all's first mistake.
Michael, when you go back in the history books and try to trace back some of the early masters of barbecue, most of them were African-American. How did we now get to a place where many of the sort of well-known chefs of barbecue are white guys?
So that you may as well ask the same question about the banjo and the blues.
There you go.
of, you know, the three B's, you know, went from the Blacks to the Bubbas. And I mean, this is you know, I want to go back to what Chuck said and what you said. Well, that upset people. You know, that's the problem. You know, one of the things I've written about in, you know, sorry, shameless plug, my forthcoming book, The Cooking Gene, is the fact that, you know, we have to get over these missing branches and missing roots in the Southern family tree, cultural family tree, and genealogical and genetic family tree that go back to African origins. And the bottom line is that they aren't barbecuing in Liverpool. They're not barbecuing in Bristol. They're not barbecuing in Kent and Somerset, you know, where Southern British folks came from, or Dublin, or Westphalia. They're barbecuing in Africa and the Caribbean, though. African Native people. And the bottom line is that one of the things that's really insulting and problematic about the way the Black agency in barbecue has been described, and I think that's why the banjo went the same way. Remember, the banjo was like, everybody knew it was an African instrument. And then the banjo became a tool of mockery through the minstrel show. And it was used to, both in the South and the North, to demean Black cultural aesthetics and creativity. So in the South, it was used to say, yep, these people are as inferior as we call it. In the North, it was used to say, see, Irish immigrants, you're better than them. And the same thing with barbecue. Barbecue, we were told, oh, yeah, old man so-and-so will barbecue for us, this Black man, Uncle so-and-so. Well, uncle, that's already disrespectful. They think it's honorific, but it's really not. It was a way of not calling a Black man sir. And then, you know, that poor Black man who's paid pennies and given a leftover plate of food, he doesn't get anything for his work. He's a master craftsman. Robert Moss says that they are recognized Black barbecuers, and other authors too, and they're very true. But most of these folks are poor. They're given leftovers. They're given pennies for what they do. And when they do it, by the way, and this is my last point, people talk about them as if they're machines, as if they're animals, as if they're trained automatons to do the job by white people. And that was Bessinger's problem, and other folks in Texas. That's their problem, too. The idea that when Black people did it, we were just trained to do it. But a good Southern white man knows exactly how to do it and do it well, because he has the brains, but the Blacks have the brawn.
So another shameless plug, one of the first attempts to reclaim the heritage of the banjo was in the Afro-American Symphony, which was the first orchestral work to use a banjo, written by my grandfather, William Grant Still, grew up in Arkansas. Kathleen, let me then read you another tweet, and that's from Roy Lee, who says, I thought fried chicken was the most political food. What do you What do you say about that?
I think that is, once again, getting into stereotypes and the assumption that all we eat in the South is barbecue and fried chicken.
That's Kathleen Purvis, food writer with the Charlotte Observer. You also heard from Michael Twitty, a blogger and food historian, and Chuck Reese, editor for The Bitter Southerner. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We've been talking about how barbecue might be the most political food in America. So let's get back to my conversation from just a few months ago with Michael Twitty, a food writer and historian, also Kathleen Purvis, food writer with the Charlotte Observer, and Chuck Reese, editor for The Bitter Southerner.
You know, the thing that we've got to remember about barbecue, every single thing that Michael has said this morning is true in my view, because so much of the history of what we eat in the South has been blotted out, like so much of our other history in the South. And now we're at a time in our history when people are becoming more willing to attempt to bring that stuff up, look at it, and attempt to reconcile with it. And the amazing thing about food is that it's a place that, okay, you can argue correctly that there were gaps between the races in the history of barbecue, and there was tension and ill will and bad action, all of that stuff. But at the same time, you look at stories where barbecue today brings people together across those barriers in ways it didn't. I mean, there's an amazing story that Kathleen could probably tell you more about, you know, a black pitmaster named Rodney Scott and a white pitmaster named Sam Jones up in North Carolina and the relationship that they've developed.
Okay. Kathleen, you want to finish that story?
Well, they are both younger. They're both descendants of long barbecue families. And I quoted from Rodney in the story that I wrote about the Bessingers that kind of started this whole thing rolling with the New Yorker. The two of them are both elevating barbecue to a certain degree. And
right.
They have a lot in common, and they're working together on that. Rodney just opened a new restaurant in Charleston that's already getting great acclaim. And Sam is the son of the grandson of Pete Jones, who started the Skylight Inn in Aden, North Carolina, and has now opened a much larger and sort of fancier barbecue restaurant not far away in Greenville, North Carolina, called Sam Jones Barbecue. And it is wonderful to see that younger thing. The other thing I would mention, though, Chuck, the one I thought you were going to when you brought that up, mm-hmm. is I've also read that there is a history in the 50s in the Carolinas of barbecue restaurants becoming, in a way, the first integrated restaurants. Because they were black-owned, they were black-cooked, but white people wanted to eat the food.
Yeah.
And so they were going to places that the rest of society didn't allow people to cross paths. And yet you found both coming together and trying to eat something that everybody loved. There's been some writing on that over the years as well, that role of sort of the shared space.
Michael, I want to read you this tweet because it sounds like, forgive me, Leonard E. Henry, who sent this tweet, if I am mischaracterizing your tweet, but it sounds very facetious to me. He says, which is more racist, mustard sauce or ketchup-based barbecue and made from pigs? Islamophobic. My goodness. So let me be the devil's advocate here, Michael, and say, look, it's just food. What if I...
Nah, it's never been just food. It's never been just food. When Tiger Woods was at the top of his game, he was just an American. He was an American who acknowledged all of his different parts. And when he did that as a human being, the first thing they did was lob at him fried chicken or collard greens or whatever the hell they eat. You are an outsider by virtue of the fact, and they didn't focus on his Asian or Native or European ancestry. They focused on that one part that pissed them off, and that was being African. And so I'm going to put it to you right now. Until people are willing and able to define for me and talk about the Nigerian, Ghanaian, Senegalese, and let's go to the next level, Wolof, Yoruba, Congo, roots of what it means to be a Southerner and an American, they can cut that. Because the bottom line is people don't know. These things were obfuscated. They were buried because they offended the sensibilities of white supremacy. And now that we have a voice and we can talk about these things, now it's not important anymore. At least, you know what, I love the writings of slaveholders and people during antebellum slavery. You know why? Because at least they gave us a little bit more credit than people do today.
What do you mean?
They when things were black, they said they were black. And they had no problem saying that because they held the keys. The mistress held the keys to the kitchen and the master held the keys to the big house. But guess what? They had no problem saying we were the best. The best chefs, the best barbecue men, the best everything. And they had no problem saying that it was our craft and our skill came from the fact that we were of African descent. At least they gave us that while they whipped us.
Todd Ream tweet. Todd Ream tweets.
I'm not playing.
Clearly.
He never does.
Todd Ream tweets, when I was in law school, some students would road trip to barbecue restaurants from Supreme Court civil rights cases. And Chuck, I'm sure that there is a feeling among some people that they don't want to have to think this deeply about food, that they just, if they like the taste of a kind of food, that they just want to eat it without having to worry about all of this heavy history.
Well, you know, such is the dilemma of intelligence, you know? I mean, it's like, here's the thing that I like about, or here's the thing that all of this tends to bring me to. What you're seeing in discussions like this is Southern culture shifting on the fly. Mm. You know, because here's the thing. Yeah, we can eat these foods and not worry about it a bit. But if we have some curiosity in us and we all want to know about our roots, now we're at a point, and it's because people like Michael are out here doing this work that we're at this point, we can go deeper into those roots than we ever have. And it's going to be tough. It raises dilemmas. But it's worth doing. And the food is tasty.
It is tasty. Chuck Reese, editor for The Bitter Southerner, also Michael Twitty, blogger and food historian, and Kathleen Purvis, food writer with the Charlotte Observer. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to talk to y'all.
Just ahead, the soul of Georgia in song. A couple more contributions to our essential playlist. First, though, we'll learn how sweet tea became the drink of the South. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Sweet tea has been sacred on Southern menus for more than 100 years. It's a very simple beverage, obviously, and these days it is everywhere and not just in Georgia. But there was a time when sweet tea was rare. So let's take a moment to relax and pour ourselves a tall glass of history.
Sweet tea really has remained a regional specialty. You cannot walk into most restaurants, unless there is a Southern restaurant, and find sweet tea on menus. My name is Tova Danovich, and I'm a freelance journalist. The first time I ever tried sweet tea was visiting my stepfather's family down in Florida. Growing up mostly on the West Coast and in the Midwest, it was not something that I had at all been exposed to.
You've got a good eye for tea. You think I can have some of that Lipton?
Come aboard.
Well, that Lipton sure looks good.
Good? It's dandy tasting.
I think those brisk Lipton iced teas were around, which are super sweetened, and so I, you know, could get those out of vending machines here and there, but finding it as something on a restaurant menu was really baffling to me. Tea has been drunk in the United States since the very earliest days of colonization. You start kind of seeing the price of black tea go down around the World War I period of time, which is not to say that that war actually affected the price of tea.
America goes to war. Men of the Army, Navy, and Marines reinforce the battlefronts on six continents to save the homes and ideals of free men from Axis domination.
But World War II, because of the involvement of green tea, specifically producing countries, you had a trade barrier that allowed black tea to actually take over from green tea. Until World War II, green and black tea were drank about equally, in equal measures throughout the United States. After World War II, black tea became immensely more popular, simply because people had switched over to drinking it during the war when it was the only tea that was readily available. And since then, Americans have continued to drink primarily black tea. We don't know exactly where it began. I believe the first known published recipe for sweet tea, as we would think of it today, is in an old Virginia housewife's cookbook.
After scalding the teapot, put into it 1 quart of boiling water and 2 teaspoonsful green tea. If wanted for supper, do this at breakfast. At dinner time, strain without stirring through a tea strainer into a pitcher.
But that isn't to say that people in other states weren't drinking sweet tea, and, you know, there may even be a small cookbook, self-published recipes traded back and forth that we have no ability to have records of today.
A squeeze of lemon will make this delicious and healthful, as it will correct the astringent tendency.
My name is Vernell Mosley, and I am a tea purveyor of Sweet Tea Factory. When I first started learning about tea, the fact that all tea comes from one plant blew me away.
When I take my sugar to tea, all the boys are jealous of me. 'Cause I never take away the gangles when I take my sugar to tea.
Here it is. André Michaux, he was a French explorer and botanist. And in the mid-1700s to early 1800s, he was noted for actually importing the actual tea plant here and planting it in Somerville, South Carolina. There was some discrepancy about what was the first tea estate, whether it was the Bigelow Estate in Charleston or this particular estate in Somerville. Then we'll take credit for, you know, being the pioneer or the one who made the, you know, wonderful discovery of tea in the U.S.
'Cause I never take where the gang goes when I take my sugar to tea.
One of the members of the House of Representatives, as a joke, created a bill that said if you're a restaurant serving unsweet tea, you must serve sweet tea. You cannot just serve unsweet tea. And he wanted to make it law for the city of Atlanta. And I thought it was a great thing. That's because I'm biased. I'm a tea purveyor, so of course I'd want everyone to serve tea as well as sweet tea.
Every Sunday afternoon, we forget about our cares.
I'm Tyler Hobbs, and I'm from Indiana. I drank sweet tea growing up. My mom actually would brew it in the sun. She'd brew it in a big pitcher and set it out in the sun all day long.
Barbara Brockway, Atlanta. I'm a Yankee, so I never drank sweet tea. Growing up, I drink unsweet tea, still do.
Calvin Williamson, Atlanta, Georgia. I like sweet tea because it was something that I've always drank from early childhood on up to now. It's just, if you're born in the South, it's just what you drink. And the sweeter, the better. I mean, if you run out of syrup, you can pour it over your pancakes.
That story was produced by GPB's Sean Powers. Just ahead, we'll pick the musical brain behind Athens band 5-8. I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. Let's add a couple more songs to our Georgia playlist. That's where we ask people to choose the best songs from and about Georgia. The rules are simple. All the songs must be written or performed by a Georgian, and musicians can't pick one of their own tunes. Today, we get the choices from frontman for the Athens band 5-8. This group has performed with R.E.M., Pylon, and the Ramones.
My name is Mike Mantioni, and I play in the band 5-8 from Athens, Georgia. My first pick is the band The Glands and the song Straight Down. The Glands came up a little after 5-8, but when I heard The Glands play, I knew where I wanted to go, and I had missed it. The just effortless play on words and the way he sang, like he was telling you a story, and it was so beautiful, and the band rocked like maybe the Velvet Underground with the Rolling Stones put together with a really bad stapler, maybe. Just that vision of the way you live when you're down and out, when you're living just for the moment. And he's listing thing after thing, the lady with the poodle, just these nutty visions that you have of things, and they just stick in your head and you're like, what? But you know, he's just basically walking down the street and it's rock and roll. And that's what I get from it. Lady with the poodle. It's in a bad way. You know, the guitars have this incredible, an incredible tremolo that he just clicks in this one spot. And it's just like, right when they hit the note, it's like, like that. And it's just like,
we'll be right back.
is a low bass, but it's not so sonically low that it's under the register. You know, it's very organically recorded. It sounds like you're right in the room with them in the band. The snare is there, the kick is there. There's a little bit of cymbal, but nothing's overwhelming. The vocals are reed thin, but they cut through. It's almost like he's whispering to you. The guitars are like razor blades, but they're not overpowering. Nothing comes through the mix and makes your ears bleed, but you wind up having to turn it up and turn it up. And by the time you're done turning it up, you are just rocking down the highway. I mean, just an incredible rock band on Capricorn, and just a lot of great stuff to say about them. So my second pick for the Georgia Music Playlist is Vic Chestnut's song, Speed Racer. Now this song is a very intense song. When I first got to Athens back in 88, I saw Vic play at the old 40 Watt, and it changed everything about my songwriting. He was a poet. He strung words together that you would never expect to hear together. A turn of phrase that was very conversational. The words that he put in were not the conversation you were expecting to have.
If I learned anything from all of these lectures, I think it's my attention span eclipsed by TV at an early age.
Speed Racer is an intensely personal song, and it's a song that basically says, I'm an atheist. And it's almost like an anthem for atheists, but it's an anti-anthem. It's like no other anthem you've ever heard.
I used to watch Speed Racer. We had that hyper attitude that carried me here to this a fluorescent enlightenment. I'm not a victim. I'm not a victim.
And he tells about Speed Racer, the TV show, which I loved as a kid, and me and Vic were around the same age. Vic does this thing with this song that no other artist could ever do, and paint this picture of a little boy, neurotic, hyperactive, who grows up to be a man who doesn't believe in God. And there's no other person on this earth that could do that. Take a tender young boy and then come up with this, like, I'm an atheist, I'm an atheist, I'm not a victim. And you have to understand, he's singing, I'm not a victim, and he's sitting in a wheelchair. And he's like, you know, just like, it's just unbelievable.
The laws of action and reaction are the closest thing to truth in the universe.
It's just him and an acoustic guitar and this really weird, almost synthesizer-sounding guitar solo thing that kind of runs throughout the song. It's like you're sitting in the room except for this crazy guitar thing that's just like, and it's just like a cat kind of scratching along the back. So imagine Vic in a wheelchair with his pick almost taped to his thumb, strumming on a nylon string classical guitar. You can hear the wood of the guitar. You can hear his hand hit it in his idiosyncratic playing with his idiosyncratic time signature and this driven kind of weird noodling sound in the background. And then his voice just bringing you through this story.
Oh,
That's Mike Mantione, frontman for the Athens band 5/8. 5/8 plays at the Vista Room in Decatur this Friday.